The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Light of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish thought and practice based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKolel, Dean of the Kolel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. The publication of this lecture, titled Life After Death, was made possible through a grant of the Ben Zion Rosen Foundation.
Pretend for a moment that you discovered Aladdin's lamp. You rub the lamp, the genie comes out, and the genie says to you, I am the possessor of infinite knowledge. Ask me any question, but only one, and I'm going back into the lamp. What question would you ask that genie? Probably some of you think maybe, what's the winning lotto number? To me, one of the most, or probably the most important question to ask the genie is there life after death? Because in the final analysis, how you view your future after death changes entirely the way you view life. You know, close your eyes for an instant. You ask yourself, who is the real me? Who? It's not your hands, it's not your feet. Where is the real essence of your identity? And there are two schools of thought of who the real you is. The secular view is that the sense of you that you have of identity is a product of the chemical and electrical workings of your brain. Once the brain stops working, the consciousness is gone forever. Because you will only live as long as your brain is viable. In this view, even if you would believe in God, in other words, you're convinced that, yes, my consciousness is part of my body, and yes, there must be a God simply because of the complexities of all the different organisms and different systems in the world. It must be designed by some super genius. But even if you do believe in God, God really doesn't care. Because in this view, there's no justice in this world. Take, for instance, the Nazi. Some commandant of some concentration camp that has murdered, tortured, maimed, traumatized thousands upon thousands of people. After the war, successfully able, change his identity, flee to South America, build a new life, lead a middle-class existence, and finally, after he's died, eulogized in the church. Where's the justice? How could this thing happen? And the answer is that if this, the life that we see, is all that there is no justice. I mean, there's just no two ways about it. There is no justice in this world. That very kind, decent, honest people suffer, and other people that are morally reproachable seem to do very well. And if there's no justice, then really God doesn't care. And if really then God doesn't care, there's really no meaning in life. You're here, You exist as long as you, the 60, 70, 80 years you'll be on this earth or more. You know, the idea is try to do the best that you can. Try to enjoy, squeeze every minute of pleasure you have, because that's all you have, and that's all there is. This view gives you tremendous freedom, because after all, if God doesn't care, the choices are limitless. Infinite, the freedom is limitless. On the other hand, there's no meaning. There's absolutely no meaning in life. And of course, we're caught in the existential trauma. This is the that which Sartre and Camus struggled with. I mean, every tick of the clock brings us to our final extinction. That's one view of life. There's another view of life, which has been up into the mid-1800s, we've been universally held by all of mankind from the dawn of time, with the exception of a small percentage of mankind. Up until the mid-1800s, virtually every individual, if asked, would say that my identity, my consciousness, is something that occupies my body, but after the death of the body, will leave that body. The analogy would be somewhat like you're strapped into a car. Strap yourself, put, go into the car, strap yourself in, turn on the ignition, you move. You can't go anyplace without the car. The car can't go anyplace without you. But you do have an existence apart from that car. According to this analogy, the true you occupies your body, but when the body no longer functions, will leave that body. According to that view, we really can't ask the question, where's justice in this world? Because we see just such a small slice of life. For instance, I'll just give you an example. You walk into a bookstore, you go in, you browse through the books, you turn to page 176, you read a paragraph there, you slam down the book, go back to the proprietor of the bookstore and says, how could you sell such stuff in your store? What's wrong? I read the paragraph in this book, this brutal murder. Nothing happened to the murderer. Where's the justice? What kind of message are you teaching to the people that you're selling this book to? He says, what's the name of that book again? He tells him, it's a great book. How much of that book did you read? Well, I told you, I read a paragraph on that page. Oh, you read is just one paragraph. Did you read what happened before that story? No. Did you read what happened afterwards? No. So how can you make any decision about the quality of that book when you just have so little to rely on? In that view, looking about our lives, our life is a paragraph in a large book. We don't know or we don't recall all that's happened before that paragraph, and we don't know what's going to happen after that paragraph. All we see now is just the paragraph that we're reading. It's very difficult to make decisions about justice if all you have is just one paragraph. In this traditional view of what consciousness is, there is justice in this world. But it's not necessarily justice that we see in our own lifetimes. It's just one paragraph. And this is shared by every single religion. The idea that consciousness is apart from the body. In this view, there's justice. In this view, there's meaning. There's a purpose to life. And generally, that which is shared by every religion, is the purpose of our being here on earth is to improve ourselves. And how you view this question, who you are, changes totally the way you live. Because again, if there is no justice, if God doesn't care, if at the end of the 70 or 80 or so years, when the body no longer functions and the brain ceases to function, if that's all there is, then the viewpoint is get every bit of pleasure you can out of this life, because that's all there is, period. There are no values, there's no justice. On the other hand, if our consciousness is not part of our body, occupies our body, we're just passing through this world, then our attitudes to this world are just so different. You know, the story is told, it was one of the great rabbis of Eastern Europe before World War II. His name was Rav Yisroel Meir Kagan. He was very often known by the first book that he wrote, which is titled The Chofetz Chaim. Chofetz Chaim. And he was known far and wide by the title of his first book, The Chofetz Chaim. And a story is told about someone, I believe the person one time lived in Chicago, a person whose origins were in Eastern Europe, came from the old world, settled here, did quite well, and in his elderly years decided to go back to the old country to see, you know, to find his roots. And while he was there, hearing about this famous rabbi, the Chofetz Chaim, he wanted to look him up. So he went to the little village of Rodin where he lived. He came to his home. And he was appalled by the rabbi's poverty. I mean, he had a table and chairs, but he didn't have furniture. And he couldn't hold himself in, and he blurted it out. And he says, you know, Rebbe says, you know, where's your furniture? And he didn't, the rabbi didn't comment immediately. A little while later asked him, you know, by the way, where's your furniture? You know, I don't see your furniture. He said, my furniture, you know, my furniture's back home, you know, I'm just passing through. He says, I'm also just passing through. The attitude of life is very much different. You're not so involved in collecting things. It's not so important. I think a very apt analogy about life according to this construct, this paradigm, is like going to college. If it's a good school, you could broaden your horizons, pick up skills that you could use for your life. If you do well in terms of your grades, it's something to build on later on for your future career. And if you're very serious while you're attending school, your life afterwards could be very, very pleasant. On the other hand, you can have loads of fun in school. I mean, you can have a great time when you're going to school. But generally, it's hard to do both. It's hard, you know, to keep on getting drunk and having a 4.0 average. It's tough. You know? And sometimes you have to make a decision. Are you just gonna have a great time, or are you going to buckle down and hit the books and get good grades? Now, if all there is to life is just college, imagine a person who is after college, he's gonna die. You know, that's it. It's finished. It's all just 4 years and it's all over. Figure, you know, what do I have to kill myself doing all this studying for? That's all there is. You know, a great time. On the other hand, if there's life after college, and there's a career, and hopefully there's a livelihood, and there's a family down the road, the whole attitude is totally different. And probably that would be the best analogy to how you view life. If this is all we have, is life in this body, enjoy yourself. If this is just a transient stage, then you have to look at it totally differently. But if this is such an important question, who you really are, is there any way of finding out the answer besides perhaps a leap of faith, you know, that you just want to believe? But is there any, realistically, is there any way to have some verification, you know, as to know, is this the right way or is that the right way? In the year 1975, a small book was published by a doctor by the name of Raymond Moody. And it became, overnight it became an international bestseller. It was called Life After Life. What this Dr. Moody did, early on in his career, he was told the story, same story, by two people that had the same thing happen to them. It was a former professor of his and a colleague, that they almost died. In other words, they were comatose, their heart had stopped, the doctors were working on them, and they both claimed that their consciousness left their body. He was intrigued with the stories, and in front of audiences, when he would be speaking, he would mention this, you know, what he had heard from his professor and from his colleague. And generally, there would be somebody in the audience there who would get up afterwards and say, you know, the same thing happened to me, and would describe his experience or her experiences. And after he collected some hundred of these stories, he put together this little book. It was such a bestseller that the next year he wrote a sequel to this called Reflections on Life After Life. And it started a whole area of research. The doctors, who were especially cardiologists, who were involved with patients who have cardiac arrest, who are near death's door, started interviewing their patients and seeing what kind of stories they had to tell. Let me tell you, for instance, one of those stories. This is written not by Dr. Moody. This is another doctor, very secular person who became a fundamentalist Christian after his research. Now, I'm not advocating that any of you should become fundamentalist Christians. But let me just tell you, and this is not the whole story, but I just took out, you know, some salient points from this little story in the book. So I'm from page 74 in this book, Beyond Death's Door. This is the doctor talking. Her face had a dark bluish tinge. Her pupils were dilated. There was no pulse. I started external heart resuscitation. She remained in a coma for 4 days. Because of the dilated pupils, it appeared that brain damage had occurred from inadequate circulation. About the second day after recovering from her coma, I asked her if she remembered anything at all. She said, "Oh, I remember you working on me." And she said all that she had. She claimed also that her consciousness had left her body, and she was hovering over her body near the ceiling and watching all that was happening. "Oh, you're working on me. You took off your plaid brown coat." I love this detail here. And threw it on the floor. "And then you loosened your tie. I also remember that your tie had white and brown stripes in it. The nurse who came to help you looked so worried. I tried to tell her I was all right. You told her to get an Ambu bag and also an Intercath to start an IV. Then the two men came in with a stretcher. I remember all of that."
in the near-death experiences that they describe, George Gallup made a poll, and using his statistical methods, he, you know, in terms of distribution of populations, he claimed that there must be, as I recall, some 8 million Americans who had some sort of this near-death experience. There are two types, we'll say, of near-death experiences. One claims, I mean, there are two parts to it. Some have one, some have the other, some have both. Their consciousness leaves their body, like this situation here. They claim to have seen all that happened in the room they were in, or perhaps outside their room. Another type is the claim, similar to the incident that Rabbi Francis brought. They claim they came to the spiritual world and describe in great detail that world. What's interesting is, despite the differences of the different people in ages, religions, background, education, the area of the country where they come from, they all say the same story. There was recently a study of children. These are children from 7 to 9 years old. There was about 100 cases also who had this, you know, they were very close to death story. They told the same story. This is not taught in Sunday school. No one has been told this except those who've researched this. I'd like to give you a sense from some of the stories of what do these people tell over. Before going to detail, let me just tell you a very fascinating incident that Dr. Moody describes in a subsequent book. In 1988, he wrote a book called The Light Beyond, which is again discusses his further research on the subject. This is a story about a woman with the name of June. What's her name? She was very close to death. She was being worked on in surgery in the hospital. She claims, this is her story, she claims, again, that her consciousness left her body. In other words, in a sense, she is there in the operating room, hovering above her body, seeing all the events, and she was bored. You know, like you've seen one operation, you've seen them all, you know? So she decided to leave the room. She went across the hall. This is how she describes her consciousness, her spiritual body. Went across the hall to the waiting room where she saw her brother-in-law. Now, her brother-in-law happened that time to bump into a friend. They started to talk. And the friend asked the brother-in-law, "Hey, what are you doing here?" And the brother-in-law replied, "You know, it looks like my sister-in-law June's about to kick the bucket. So I have to cut short my fishing trip. It looks like I'm going to be one of the pallbearers that are at the funeral." Well, June heard enough. She went back to the room, and she did make it. She survived the operation. And in the recovery room, when she came to and the brother-in-law came to visit her, her first words to the brother-in-law were, "Next time you're planning a fishing trip, go right ahead. I'll be just fine." And it looked like he was going to have a near-death experience. This is not at all atypical. There was a story that I read, the account written by a doctor, was published, in a Detroit paper. But I read it, you know, from the book itself. A fascinating story of a woman who was having an operation, who claimed, again, that in the process, you know, these are people who are very, very sick, you have to realize. I mean, they're holding on by a thread. She left, again, her consciousness left her body. She didn't go to the recovery room on this side. She went through the window on that side. I mean, this is her story. And she described, I don't think it was the story that she had her, but she went around the hospital. And she told it, you know, and her, when she came to afterwards, she told the doctor her story, you know, that I left. And you know, there's a tennis shoe which is perched in a very strange position on a ledge on the third floor. And she described how it looked. He wanted to check it out. He went, he, you know, stuck his head out the, you know, where the room where the surgery was, and he couldn't see anything. He went up to the third floor, went into each room, you know, excused himself, you know, went into these were patients in there, excused himself. He just walks in, looks out the window, and keeps go door. He went from door to door till he found the tennis shoe that was perched on, and he couldn't get to it. He had to get a stick, and he had to, till he finally got that tennis shoe, and it was perched where she'd set it, and it had that, whatever the details of that, how that tennis shoe looked. Let me give you just some of the, give you a sense of some of the stories that these people say. I saw them resuscitating me. It was really strange. I wasn't very high. It was almost like I was on a pedestal, but not above them to any great extent, just maybe looking over them. I tried talking to them, but nobody could hear me. No one would listen to me. A few of my kids like that sometimes. The doctors and nurses were pounding on my body, this is another person, to try to get IVs started and to get me back. And I kept trying to tell them, this again, these are people who claim that their consciousness left their body. Leave me alone. All I want is to be left alone. Quit pounding on me. But they didn't hear me. So I tried to move their hands to keep them from beating on my body, but nothing would happen. I couldn't get anywhere. It was like, I don't really know what happened. I just couldn't move their hands. It looked like I was touching their hands. I tried to move them, yet when I would give it the stroke, their hands were still there. I don't know whether my hand was going through it, around it, or what. I didn't feel any pressure against their hands when I was trying to move them. Or people were just walking up from all directions to get to the wreck. I could see them. And I was in the middle of a very narrow walkway. Anyway, as they came by, they wouldn't seem to notice me. They would just keep walking with their eyes straight ahead. As they came real close, I would try to turn around to get out of their way, but they would just walk through me. Do you ever remember Topper? Many of them, though, described not only in clear detail events of what occurred to them in this physical world, but claimed that they had left the physical world and gone to a spiritual world. Here's an example. I got up and walked into the hall to go get a drink. It was at that point, as they found out later, that my appendix ruptured. I became very weak and I fell down. I began to feel a sort of drifting, a movement of my real being in and out of my body. And to hear beautiful music. I floated on down the hall and out of the door into the screened-in porch. There it almost seemed the clouds, a pink mist really, began to gather around me. Then I floated right straight on through the screen, just as though it weren't there, and up into this pure, crystal, clear light, an illuminating white light. Talmudic literature describes the divine presence would often come to certain people before they died. It was beautiful and so bright, so radiant, but it didn't hurt my eyes. It's not any kind of light you can describe on earth. I didn't actually see a person this light, yet it has a special identity. It definitely does. It's a light of perfect understanding and perfect love. the thought came to my mind. You know, this is the thing, lovest thou me? You know, this is not exactly in the form of a question, but I guess the connotation of what the light said was, if you do love me, go back and complete what you began in your life. And all during this time, I felt as though I were surrounded by an overwhelming love and compassion. Others who were, and it seems to the longer the period, you know, where the person was out, you know, or where the doctors least expected the person to recover, are more vivid, the you know, clear the memories, or at least have more to say, they experienced more. Very often, those, and this is what he, in his reflections on life after life, Dr. Moody describes people who not just left their bodies, went to a spiritual world, but also were involved, saw what they were doing. And life in that spiritual world would be akin to a great university, a great yeshiva. I mean, the experience is as of gaining knowledge. At least this is how they describe this, many different people. In fact, those who've had this complete experience, this near-death experience, and come back, for them, their life has totally changed. Because these people those who claim they've had this experience, almost without exception, claim that there are really only two important things in life. Love, sharing, giving, and gaining knowledge. And people who wouldn't pick up a book afterwards would start studying, would start learning. Not trivia, you know, but wisdom. In fact, as Dr. Moody gave up his practice of medicine and full-time works in counseling people who've had near-death experiences because it creates tremendous strains on the marriage. The wife complains, you know, this man who is a type A personality is not the man I married. He became a lamb. You know, he became this mystic, you know, or this person full of love and patience and wisdom, and, you know, this isn't the man I married. And it really creates all kinds of problems. And he really is devoted, his whole thing is to the counseling of people who've had near-death experiences. The purpose of me telling you this, and all of these experiences have Jewish parallels, and this is all, is not just to take my word for it, but I think it's very important for you to pick up the book Life After Life in the library. In the section, there are many books of similar nature of physicians or other researchers who are involved in this study. It's really worthwhile to pick up the books yourselves and start reading, because it opened up an entirely different vista. Because again, it's not just a matter of curiosity here. Well, is there life after life or not life after life? It changes everything we do. Because if there's a life after life, we have to view life totally differently. There's another, I would just like to touch upon another area of research which bears on the question of life after life. And because of the time constraints, I'll finish with that story, and I'll open the floor to questions. One of the major problems of life, and this is the questions we've asked, that really bothers virtually every philosopher, is the problem of suffering. Why do people suffer? As Jews, we ask ourselves the question,
how could we explain the Holocaust? I mean, how could such a thing occur? The traditional Jewish view of suffering, and this is something which is repeated in the Torah, it's the subject of much Talmudic discussion, is that there is justice in this world. No one suffers unjustly. And one of the major problems of that answer to explain suffering, to explain suffering, to say that people suffer because of their shortcomings, because of their crimes or misdemeanors, that's fine, but why do small children suffer? What do they do? Part of the Jewish mystical tradition, this is a point which is mentioned very often in the Zohar, this is the classic Jewish mystic text, is the notion of reincarnation. This is not necessarily the first time we have been here, nor perhaps the last. And we don't, just like the person we started, who opens up the paragraph from page 176, we don't see the whole story. And we don't know the background of this child that suffers. I'd like to share with you part of the research. And there's a whole body of research, and again, I advise you to do your own research. One of the great researchers in the field of reincarnation memories is a doctor by the name of Ian Stevenson. He wrote a book called 20 Cases Suggestive Reincarnation. But there is other research, and I think it's really worthwhile to investigate. Recently, in the city of Bnei Brak, it's a suburb of Tel Aviv in Israel, in the 1950s, there was a child born who was able to have recall of vast areas of Talmudic literature, and he never studied it. He was just a little boy. You know, let me tell you, I study Talmud the whole day. It's hard enough remembering what you've studied. To remember what you didn't study, that's a kunz, you know, that's really a feat. And here was a child who was able, had recall, and there are many people who saw him and spoke to him of things that he did not pick up in this lifetime. I'd like to share with you, though, a story of a girl from India. This is not in the book of the 20 cases of Ian Stevenson. Even though he does in another work, he does speak of this. This particular version of the story is taken from a book of Critical Examination of the Belief in Life After Death by C.J. Dukasi, who was a professor of philosophy in Brown University. Here, the case of Shanta Devi. In 1936, a pamphlet was printed in Baluja Press in Delhi, India, setting forth the results of an inquiry into the case of Shanta Devi. I'm not good at Indian names. You know, Sitting Bull's okay, but the real Indian ones are tough. Lala Deshtabunda Gupta, the managing director of the Daily Tej. Pandit Neki Ram Sharma, a leader in the nationalist movement. He was a colleague of Gandhi's. And Mr. Tara Chand Mathur, an advocate. They wrote this pamphlet in 1936. The chief facts recorded in their statements are as follows. They concern a girl, Kumari Shanta Devi, born October 12, 1926, in Delhi, daughter of B. Rang Badahur Mathur. From the age of about 4, she began to speak of a former life of hers in Mutra, a town about 100 miles from Delhi, saying that she was then a Choban by caste, that her husband was a cloth merchant, that her house was yellow. These are all... She's in Delhi and she's recounting a life that she claims she experienced in Mutra. Later, she told a grand uncle of hers, Mr. Bishan Chand, that her husband's name in her previous life had been Kedar Nath Chowbi. The uncle mentioned this to Mr. Lala Kishan Chand, M.A., a retired principal, who asked to meet the girl. She then gave him the address of Kedar Nath, to whom he wrote. To his surprise, it turned out that Kedar Nath Chowbi actually existed. And in his reply to the letter, he confirmed various of the details Shanta Devi had given and suggested the relative of his in Delhi, Kanjimal, interview the girl. When he came to see her, she recognized him as a cousin of her former husband and gave convincing replies to questions of his concerning intimate details. Kedar Nath Chowbi then, on November 13, 1935, came to Delhi with his present wife and his 10-year-old son by his former wife. Shanta Devi recognized Kedar Nath and was greatly moved, answering convincingly various questions asked by him about private matters of her former life as his wife, and mentioning that she had buried 150 rupees in a certain room of her house in Mutra. In another account of this story, I read that she challenged her husband, her former husband, and says, "How could you do this? Before I died, you promised me you'd never remarry." When I said this over to another class, one of them said, "Oh no, even after they die, you can't get rid of them." But it says, after they left, she kept asking to be taken to Mutra, describing various features of the town. On November 24, 1935, she and her parents and the three inquirers who authored the pamphlet went to Mutra. On the railway platform, an elderly man and the group of people there paused for a moment in front of her, and she recognized him, saying that he was her Jeth, the elder brother of her former husband. The party then took a carriage whose driver was instructed to follow whatever route the girl told him. She mentioned that the road to the station had not been asphalted when she lived in Mutra, and she pointed out various buildings which had not existed then. You know, things have changed, you know. She led the party to the lane in which there was a house, which was a house she had formerly occupied. In the lane, she met and recognized an old Brahmin, whom she correctly identified as her father-in-law. She identified the old house, now rented to strangers, two gentlemen of Mutra, who then joined the party, asked her where the Jai Zarur of the house was, a local expression which the party from Delhi did not understand. She, however, understood it and pointed out the privy, which in Mutra that term is used to designate. In other words, there are three very educated gentlemen who did not know what this word meant, and because it was the local dialect. And here this girl knew the local dialect of Mutra. After leaving the old house, and she led the way to the newer one, still occupied by Chowbi Kedar Nath, she recognized her former brother, now 25 years old, and her uncle-in-law. At the house, she was asked to point out the well she had mentioned in Delhi. There is now no well in the courtyard there, but she pointed out the place to where it had been. Kedar Nath then lifted the stone with which it had since been covered. She then led the way to the room she said she had formerly occupied, where she had buried the money. She pointed to the spot which was then dug up, and about a foot down a receptacle for keeping valuables was found, but no money was in it. Kedar Nath Chowbi later disclosed that he had removed it after the death of his first wife, Lugdi, at the age of 23, on October 4th, 1925, following the birth of her son on September 25th. Later, Shantideva recognized her former father and mother in a crowd of over 50 persons. The pamphlet reproduces also the confirmatory statement of Kedarnath's cousin in Delhi, Chaubi Kenji Mal, including a statement of the questions he asked Shantideva when he interviewed her and her replies. In the early 1960s, Ian Stevenson went back to India and interviewed those people who were still alive, in other words, who, and again confirmed the details of this pamphlet. The purpose of relating these this story and the stories about near-death experiences are not merely curiosities. Again, this is evidence which has to be weighed, and evidence that has to be researched. And I think it's something which you should research on your own, which greatly affect the way we should look at life. Because if this, all of this is true, which there is much, if one truly reads through all the research here, which much of it is very compelling, if all of this is true, we really have to ask ourselves very serious questions then. Because we're just going to pass through this existence. And we may be asked, have we really fulfilled our potential here? Have we done all we could in this transitory stage to make ourselves better people? And it's really... for many of us, and it's often a question we don't like to ask ourselves. We feel comfortable in what we're doing. We don't like to somehow disturb the status quo. Things are fine, but we always have to ask ourselves: are we really living in a fool's paradise? Is the view that we have of life really true? And if all of this evidence is true, and again, I really hope that really you do your own research in this, myself included, you'll have to really seriously think about how to maximize our life in this phase of our existence, to try to make ourselves better people. Okay, are there any questions? Yes?
Well, any of these stories that related contradict anything in Jewish alchemy?
No, absolutely not. They confirm them. Yes?
You know, I could take this differently. If a person's lifetime in this world is to do good deeds and amass a treasure of, you know, good deeds, so that in the afterlife, you're judged and they ask how you're done, that's one thing. But if you know now, well, you'll have a second chance, and you'll be coming back for a third chance, and you'll just be reincarnated, then, you know, then what's the point in doing everything right the first time? Hey, you know, you're going to be coming back second or third time, then,
Maybe
you're taking...
Yeah, like we have all the time in the world,
yeah,
right?
No rush.
What's the rush? Let me try to answer the question here about, you know, what's the rush? In other words, you know, you have all the time in the world, right? With an interpretation of an interesting passage in the Talmud that was suggested by the famous Gaon of Vilna. This is the great genius and saint who lived in the city of Vilna, Lithuania, over 200 years ago. There's a passage in the Talmud which is very difficult. There's a question in the Talmud, a theological question, between two great schools of Talmudic scholars. One, the house of Hillel, Beis Hillel, and the other, the house of Shammai, called Beis Shammai. And the question there, which is atypical of the questions which they deal with, or which are very this-worldly and very legal, the question there is, it better to for a person to have been created or not to have been created? This is how the Talmud phrases the question. And it says that they disputed this point for 2.5 years. Till finally they came, both sides came to the conclusion it was best not to be created. But now that a person's created, one should evaluate his life and try to fix up his life. The Gaon of Vilna interprets this that it's not to be taken exactly literally. Their question was based on this belief in reincarnation. Pretend a person is holding the last moments of his life. He has completed all that he has to do on this world, so he does not have to come back to another reincarnation. But there's one thing still lacking. Is it best, in other words, theoretically, of course, be best not to do that one thing, come back, have another opportunity of life, and do so much more good? Or should you stop while you're ahead? I don't know if any of you here have visited Las Vegas, but if you're on a roll and you keep on winning, there's a certain thing that, you know, you just keep on going. Or when do you say stop and to cash in your chips? This is really the question. Is it best to stop, complete it, don't come back? Or, on the other hand, give it a chance and come back again? They concluded it's best stop while you're ahead, because you don't know how much damage you could do to yourself if you come back again. But now, if you are back, now after he is back, what should he do? We don't have recall, unless under hypnosis, but we don't have recall of previous lifetimes. What are we supposed to fix up here? We're back here, I mean, possibly for something, some shortcoming, some area that we have to perfect ourselves. How do we zero in on that area? So he says, Yafashbesh b'maisav, Mashmesh b'maisav, a person should do some real soul searching. Find those areas where he has weaknesses in. He has certain, he's attracted to certain things which really he knows rationally are things which are unbecoming, should not be done. Those are those areas that he has come back for. Those are the areas he should work on. So according to this, it's not, you don't know how much, just like the person that keeps on piling chips by the roulette wheel, you don't know the time where you may lose all your chips. Okay? What's the next question? Yes.
Yeah, Rabbi, I don't want to underestimate the importance of searching for the truth. But as you point out, people have looked at this question of afterlife for thousands of years. Nobody's been able to develop a definitive answer. We've got people like Dr. Mooney, who probably interviewed hundreds of people who had these, you know, near-death experiences, and he hasn't come up with a definitive answer. So I ask myself, you know, how do I approach this? And this may be a simplistic answer, but we're dealing with an area of uncertainty. Maybe there's an afterlife, maybe there isn't. But can you afford to take the chance that there isn't?
There is.
And you know, when you live your life based on the idea that maybe there's an afterlife, and if there is one, I don't want to spoil it now.
There's really two parts to your comments. It's two. One is it verifiable? And B, even if it's not verifiable, but it's worthwhile just because of doubt, to do what's ultimately the best thing. That second thing is really, there's a noted quote from Pascal, a famed philosopher, mathematician, who was a practicing Catholic, who, although not convinced of the verity of Catholicism, still didn't want to burn, you know, forever in hell, and therefore acted like a good Catholic, and that's what he based himself on. But I'd like to comment on the first part of this, which is, again, a personal philosophy of mine in life, so I just to share it with you. In life, generally, we do not have the comfort of having the same type of proof that we have in a confined system, mathematical system, like geometry, for instance, where every theorem is proven on the basis of the laws of logic, having your axioms and your postulates, and building from there. And if I make a statement, I will definitely prove or not prove my statement. There are certain things I can prove deductively. There are certain things I can prove inductively. The rate of gravity. Well, I'll do enough experiments. I'll propose a certain law. I will see if I had as predictive power. Then I can assume that this I've discovered a real law. But generally, we live life with uncertainty. You make a decision you're going to marry somebody. That decision is really going to affect you the rest of your life. Are you 100% certain the marriage is going to work out? To the best of your knowledge, you feel that the right elements are there for the marriage to work out. It's a guess. It's based on probability. And that's the basis how we make our decisions. I just think there's a fellow I happened to meet when I was visiting Miami. He at one time had studied in a yeshiva in Cleveland, Ohio. And he was in the doctor's office. He had taken off time from his studies, from his regular schedule of classes, to go to the doctor's appointment. The doctor was running late. So he was worried. He didn't want to spend that much time in the doctor's office. He left and as the waiting room, went to the, you know, to the next room where the nurses were, you know, the reception area, to talk to them perhaps about rescheduling because he didn't want to miss his class. While he was talking, there was a large bang in the waiting room. Evidently, a car had run out of control, had skipped over had gone over the curb, smashed into the waiting room, and killed all the people that were in that waiting room. He lucked, whatever it was, I mean, he was saved. You know, waiting rooms could be very dangerous places. If someone would ask me and would have this fear of, you know, I don't want to go to a doctor's waiting room because it's dangerous. You know, someone died there. There's no way that I could disprove those fears. There's no way I can prove to him he will not die. Absolutely no way. All I can do is to show the evidence that the chances of this happening are so minute that on that basis you have to make a decision. Because after all, if you stay home, look at the poor people in Lockerbie in Scotland. Those who are on the ground, they're minding their business. The plane, the Pan Am jet exploded. The pieces fell down and killed many people on the ground. You know, even staying in a house could be dangerous. Really, at what point, and really, there is no, we really are never, ever sure of anything. We work with probabilities. I mean, that's the basis how we make decisions in day-to-day life. This is the basis how you make decisions on choosing your career, choosing a mate, choosing the school for your kids. I mean, it's based on probabilities. And I think if you research all the evidence that's there, In my opinion, I mean, just under normal circumstances, of course, I don't know how it is in day-to-day life, but if one researches all this opinion, I think that there's more certainty to the fact that there's life after death than that this business partnership or the choice of career is the right one. And I think that's, I don't think it's fair, because we don't make decisions with certainty. We make certain decisions based on probability, you know, and I think that's, at least that's the thing that governs my own life, you know, and I feel comfortable there. Let me just make another comment, though. We discussed the aspect of the identity of our consciousness, you know, who we are, right? We didn't discuss, even though these concepts are Jewish, these are shared by many non-Jews as well. I mean, virtually this is the heritage of mankind. What's unique about the Jewish experience is really, because this is the backdrop of Torah. This is not Torah. The fact is, you look at yourself as a spiritual being, and if this is true, that we are, our consciousness just occupies our body, then each one of us is an angel, you know, is really a spiritual being. We should look at ourselves differently. We should look at our colleagues, our employees differently. A human being is an angel. It's a spiritual being. That view which is shared by the Torah is not particularly Jewish. This view is really a universal view, which is really accepted virtually by all mankind. What's unique about the Torah is really, this is a system, and of course one has to study it, of course, which is a guide how to live life. In other words, how to fuse the spiritual and the physical in day-to-day life. You know, so, and that's really what the, this is the classes of the, you know, the Chicago Community Kollel. You know, it's about when you're getting Torah classes. The word Torah means a guide. And it's the guide how to live life, to it, living life to its spiritual fullest. But I think it's important as a backdrop, before one even starts studying Torah, that if one has the appreciation of who or she really is, the person really is, that they are spiritual beings, that we are just passing through life, I think it gives a greater meaning of any, you know, it's the fertile soil. Just the way I look at things, I think that one of the major problems of American Jewry is, and these are, would certainly apply to the problems that Reform or the conservative temples have, those Jews that are unaffiliated have, is it's very hard, if one has the secular view of what a human being is, that we are our body, that our consciousness is the product of the chemical and electrical workings of our brain. And ultimately then, there's no purpose. Everyone, it's the end is the same for everyone. It's hard in that backdrop to assimilate and to fuse the idea of Torah. Because it's like planting a seed in salt. You know, it's not fertile soil. And therefore that's why it just so, that instead of going to a shul, going to a temple, and seeking a spiritual way of living, all you have are the trappings of certain customs and songs and Because philosophically, it really doesn't make a difference according to, or at least to the many of the people who are there. Philosophically, it really makes a difference what they do, if they go there or they don't go there, and if they're out golfing, it really doesn't make a difference. The end is all the same. They're there to have a meaningful or a joyful experience. You know, so to that extent, it's the traditions, it's the songs, but to have it as a real theology, a way to guide your life, to elevate yourself, it really, you know, the philosophy isn't there that it will grab. And I think there's a major problem that the Jewry as a whole has. You know, they've taken studies over a period of 20 years, and it seems some 70% of all Americans believe in life after life. You know, regular Americans. But I think if you took a poll amongst Jews, you ask what percent of Jews believe in life after life, I think it would be much, much less. Much, much less. And if you have that viewpoint that you don't believe in life after life, it's a real conflict of how do you understand your Jewishness. Like, because really nothing matters. You know, so. Yes? Yeah.
In Judaism, we believe in reincarnation. When we die, we should ask for every day, and we pray to God to resuscitate the dead. Which life is he, are we praying for him to bring back?
That is a very, very good question. It's really a matter of discussion in the Kabbalistic, you know, works. And the answer that I'm most comfortable with is stay tuned. It's coming soon. Yeah. In other words, you'll see it. Don't worry. And in other words, you know, it's in the Middle Ages they were debating, you know, how many, you know, the amongst the scholastic, the Catholic scholars, of how many angels would fit on the head of a pin. You know, I think it's very theoretical. You know, it's we'll see. The idea of Tchias HaMeisim is very much part of Jewish belief. The idea of reincarnation is very much part of the Kabbalistic tradition. And both are true. The question is, which body? Is it the final one? Is it the one you started off with? Is really a discussion amongst the mystics themselves. I don't really think it's, according to this, and there are different forms of reincarnation. What we are dealing with is the reincarnation of your consciousness. Your identity is the same. You are you. There's a you there. You may occupy a different body, but that's you. And there's this Shantideva, for instance, who had the memory. That's the same person. I mean, it's the same spiritual consciousness. You're just occupying now a different body. But it's the same, you know, person, same consciousness.
So what's the difference between
Judaism and incarnation? So the difference... Now, basically now, you see, I was told by Rabbi Francis that I have a limited time to be here. In 25 words or less, though, let me just explain, what is Judaism? What is Judaism? There are two parts of Judaism. I mean, we said, you know, being Jew, there's two parts. One is the basic idea that God is interested in us, and has created an agenda, a system of how we should live life. That system, he told us in no uncertain terms, it was a mystical experience that was experienced by millions of people together at Mount Sinai when they heard the Ten Commandments. Judy, there is not one mystic who feels he's heard the voice of God and tells his followers, it's your parents, your grandparents, as our ancestors who were there, who recorded it, who lived by it for thousands of years. But, yeah, so there's one aspect, just one part of it is, of Judaism is, if this is at least how Jews look at this, this is God's system of how to live life. The second part is, there's a unique role for Jews because Jews are the priesthood of humanity. Just like there's within Jewry themselves, there's the Kohanim, you know, there's the priests, and there's the laity. In a certain sense, within humanity itself, there is a priesthood and a laity. Jews are the priests of humanity. And being priests, like priests in any culture, they have a specific guidelines to live their life, a much more hallowed way of living. The Torah that we have, how Jews believe, is God's personal plan for mankind as a whole. I mean, there's behavior that governs every human being, and there's behavior that governs specifically Jews. And as that, we have, as Jews, a very special relationship with God. Well, that's why we call we're the chosen people. We are God's priests. How we got there, why are we more than anyone else, is A, we said yes, you know. We opted for it. Nobody else wanted it. You know? And B, we have Choshev HaZedus, you know. We come from ancestors that were very holy people, very, very special people. And these people opted for it, and we are their descendants. That's 25 words or less.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237.